This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon and welcome to Live and Learn on the Bigger Picture. I'm PJ Thumb and I'm a historian from the University of Oxford, and this is the history of Singapore. Episode 42, Hobson's Choice. On the 21st of July 1961, 13 People's Action Party assemblymen were expelled from the party. They had abstained on a motion of confidence in the government. This action finally precipitated a split between the left and right wings of the PAP. Around two-thirds of the party membership, including 35 of 51 branches and 19 of 23 organizing secretaries, resigned with the 13 assemblymen. On the 29th of July, they formed the new party, the Barisan Socialists, or Malay for Socialist Front. They saw themselves as the legitimate heirs of the PAP, which had been hijacked and taken astray by a right-wing leadership, and they vowed to continue the struggle against colonialism and for the achievement of an independent, non-communist, socialist Malaya. Lim Chin Siong was elected Secretary General. Now, if we look at the memoirs, the autobiographies, the interviews of the main leaders of Singapore at this time on all sides, we see a divergence between how they looked back on this period and how the people at the time responded to this event. Politicians on all sides perceived the creation of the Barisan Socialists as a permanent and profound alteration of Singapore's political situation. They would later invariably recall the split as the defining political moment of modern Singapore. But the public barely reacted. Singaporean politics was viciparous, and splits had a long history, dating back all the way to the Kuomintang split between right and left in 1927. Every single political party in Singapore had undergone or was the product of a split. Every single one. The PAP itself had nearly split in 1958 and had actually done so just the year before. So public response to the split was a collective sigh and shrug. Nor did popular opinion believe in the PAP's declarations that this was a break between the non-communists and communists. This rhetoric was old and tired. The Sin Chiu Jitpo wrote, quote, "In this atmosphere of suspicion and fear, there are people who are constantly haunted by unnecessary fears in their hearts. Superficial debaters and inattentive editorialists habitually explain Singapore's current political situation using communism as a one-size-fits-all explanation." The Sin Chiu Jitpo hit out at British officials and the Western media for their obsession with the split, condemning their, quote, "simplistic explanations," unquote, and, quote, "sweeping generalizations," unquote, of Singapore's political situation. The problem, it argued, was that while the issues Singaporeans faced were numerous and complex, all foreigners cared about was what Singapore's politics would have on the world situation and on their own country's interests. Therefore, they were only interested in whether Singapore was leaning left or right. The Sin Chiu Jitpo continued, quote, "The comments made by the foreigners have little to do with the feelings of the local people. We cannot jump to the conclusion that the internal strife of the PAP represents the entire political situation in Singapore," unquote. And indeed, the press dismissed the PAP split as, quote, "not the real heart of the matter," unquote. The important question in people's minds was merger, and coverage of the issue far outweighed coverage of the PAP split. And in this regard, Lee Kuan Yew had judged the situation correctly. He had sought merger, pursued merger, on the premise that it would make Singapore's people forget about everything else. It would divert attention away from his governance, or lack thereof, away from his broken promises, away from his continued detention of political prisoners. And because he controlled access to the British and to the Federation, he controlled merger. and with public attention now focusing on merger, the Barisan would have to battle Lee and the PAP on a field of Lee's choosing, with weapons that Lee had chosen, for a prize that Lee controlled access to, and with their hands tied behind their back. You get the idea. At this point in time, when the Barisan was formed in late July 1961, the exact structure and constitutional arrangements of merger were not known. However, Lim Chin Siong pointed out that merger could not be separated from colonialism because any merger arrangement would have to be approved by both Britain and the Federation of Malaya, and they, quite rationally, would not agree to arrangements that did not protect their own interests. Meanwhile, and indeed throughout the merger campaign, Lim continued to attack Lee Kuan Yew over the issues that had caused the PAP split, emphasizing his arrogant and secretive nature, his failure to keep election promises. And over the ensuing months, Lim repeatedly emphasized that, quote, "the fundamental problem is still opposing colonialism," unquote. The Barisan were completely in favor of merger in principle, but they feared that the merger that we were going to get would be colonialism in disguise. And the following month, August 1961, the proposed details of the agreement on merger were released as a white paper. The speed at which it had been produced confirmed that it had secretly been negotiated for quite a while, and the Barisan were horrified by the contents. It was what they feared. Singapore would be transferred from one colonial master to another, from London to Kuala Lumpur, and would be locked into a form of quasi-colonialism. We would have fewer rights in Malaysia than we had enjoyed under self-government as a British colony. And under the terms, citizens of Singapore could only vote in Singapore. This would quarantine Singapore from federation politics, as the Tunku wanted, effectively keeping the two territories separate. Singapore would also be underrepresented in the Dewan Rakyat, the federal parliament. It would have only 15 seats instead of the 24 or 25 that it should have based on population size. This meant that a federal government in which Singapore was only partially represented would control internal security. And if, as we've discussed previously, the manifestation of colonialism in Singapore was a lack of democratic, accountable control of internal security, then the proposed terms would lock Singapore into a perpetual state of colonialism in Malaysia. Lim Chin Siong stated angrily that, quote, "according to Mr. Lee's arrangements, the Federation government will exercise absolute political sovereignty over Singapore's people by controlling the internal security of Singapore. But half of Singapore's citizens will be deprived of their right to elect their representatives at the federal parliament, which will rule over them. Isn't this betrayal?" Unquote. Accordingly, the Barisan stated they would only accept a merger in which Singapore was equally represented, with all Singapore citizens becoming full citizens of Malaysia on an equal basis with other states. A full and equal merger. But the PAP dismissed this on the grounds that the Federation had different criteria for citizenship, which would strip many Singaporeans of their citizenship. The Barisan pointed out Article 22 of the Federation Constitution gave its parliament latitude to decide who qualified for citizenship. After all, when Penang and Malacca joined the Federation, all of their citizens were automatically converted to Federation citizens, even those who did not meet the criteria. More importantly, they pointed out, the government of Singapore should be trying to preserve Singaporean rights, negotiating with the Federation government for Singapore rights, not giving them away because a foreign government demanded it. Chin Siong demanded, quote, "do they represent Singapore or the Federation government?" Unquote. Lee Kuan Yew argued that Singapore's government would retain crucial decision-making powers. But Lim reiterated that only a representative government responsible and directly accountable to the people of Singapore, would make decisions to benefit Singapore. And he said, quote, once the Federation has control of Singapore's internal security, it will exercise complete and absolute political sovereignty over all Singaporeans. Under the circumstances, what is the use of other decision-making powers? Unquote. See, this is where the issue of colonialism is all important. And this is why we took time to discuss this in episode 37, The Nature of Colonialism. Those of you who listen to it will remember the discussion of what colonialism is. As long as a government has arbitrary power to arrest and detain citizens, it has the ability to overrule all other decisions. So it doesn't matter if Singapore has even total internal autonomy, because if the federal government in Kuala Lumpur can use its Internal Security Act to detain Singaporeans without trial, and Singaporeans are not fully representative in the federal parliament, then Singapore would still be a colony of Kuala Lumpur. But the problem was, this argument went over the heads of the public. They were not very concerned about the political implications of merger. Local discussions chiefly focused on the practical implications of merger and resolving key policy differences. The Chinese community focused, for example, on vernacular education, which had suffered in the Federation. Businessmen focused on economic issues. Workers thought about their labour rights. Malays wondered about their rights because, as Malays, the constitution guaranteed them privileges as the indigenous people. But as Singaporeans, they would have fewer rights than Malays in the rest of Malaysia. So how would this contradiction be resolved? Indeed, such was the focus on practical issues that the Nanyang Shangpao went so far as to argue that political unity was not so urgent because it would likely follow economic integration. For the Chinese press, at least, the Barisan's concerns over the political structure of Malaysia was a minor issue compared to ensuring that the economic issues were ironed out. And unfortunately, they were kind of correct. As history has shown, the economic issues were never ironed out before the creation of Malaysia, and the tensions over the economic issues would be a driving force behind the eventual separation. So, as such, the Barisan were fighting an uphill battle to explain the political implications of merger. The leaders of the Barisan, of course, had been barred from running in the 1959 elections, and so they were not in the assembly to make speeches. And Malayan newspapers were pressured into not publishing anything favourable to the left. Lee Kuan Yew used government dominance of the airwaves to make a series of radio speeches titled The Battle for Merger. And this was a series riddled with half-truths and even a few outright lies, and later published the speeches into a book under that title. Merger was the PAP's panacea. They would just cast all opposition to the government as being against merger. So, for example, the government barely botched educational reforms. But any opposition to these botched reforms would be explained as the Barisan hoping to thwart, quote, the rising tide of merger on the injured bodies of school children, unquote. As if one had anything to do with the other. Because, you see, unlike the Barisan, Lee Kuan Yew was not handicapped by concerns over issues of principle or sovereignty. He was solely focused on keeping himself in power by delivering a form of merger that was acceptable to both Singapore's public, in particular, of course, the Chinese public, and also the Federation leadership. As Lee explained to British Deputy Commissioner Philip Moore, the Chinese wanted merger, but feared losing their hard-won rights. They feared Chinese schools becoming English or Malay language schools. They feared labour, trade unions being suppressed. They feared traders being devastated by the Federation's tariff barriers or businessmen paying higher tax rates. And most of all, they feared losing their citizenship. So he was therefore singularly focused on crafting a merger agreement that gave Singapore autonomy in precisely these areas: education, labour, the economy, citizenship, and thereby eroding the Barisan's electoral base and forcing the Barisan to oppose a popular position. Never mind if these concessions would make merger untenable in the long run. He needed merger to stay in power now. Looking back from our vantage point today, it's clear that the Barisan had no chance of winning. The game was rigged from the beginning. And also, the Barisan simply weren't as good politicians as Lee Kuan Yew, who would repeatedly outmaneuver them politically. He would just run rings around them. See, let me illustrate. As I mentioned, the Barisan stated they would only accept a merger in which Singapore was equally represented, full and equal merger, with all Singapore citizens becoming full citizens of Malaysia on an equal basis with the other states. But the PAP dismissed this on the grounds that the Federation had different criteria for citizenship, which would strip many Singaporeans of their citizenship. And the Tunku backed up the PAP here and said joining as equal members of Malaysia would make many of Singapore's Chinese citizens lose their citizenship. So this was a politically untenable position, so the Barisan switched to proposing full independence, and hence full control over internal security as a way to achieve self-determination and prove that Singapore was not becoming communist before merging with the Federation. This allowed the PAP to attack them as being against merger and hence anti-Malayan. Lim Chin Siong countered by quoting Lee Kuan Yew's statement that merger was, quote, as inevitable as the rising and setting of the sun, unquote. And if so, he argued, it did not matter if Singapore became independent first. But the public was mindful that before May 1961, the Tunku had been growing less and less enthusiastic about merger. If this opportunity was not seized, it might never come again. The PAP's deal was flawed, but I guess a flawed deal was better than none. But Lee spun it another way. He said, yes, merger is inevitable, so Singapore had better get the best deal it could get, because if it got a worse deal, it would be stuck with it forever. And we see this pattern play out again and again over the ensuing months. The Barisan would criticize the details of merger. If they had a valid point, Lee could simply go to Kuala Lumpur and secretly negotiate a compromise with the Tunku that invalidated the Barisan's point. He could then go back to Singapore, draw out the Barisan, wait till they had committed themselves to the argument, then simply announce his compromise at an advantageous moment, and thus make the Barisan look like idiots. If he could not get a compromise from the Tunku, he could simply announce that, oh, no, the Federation won't accept it, and if the Federation won't accept it, then no merger. And don't you want merger? So, without access to the Tunku, the Barisan could not propose any concrete alternatives to merger. Simply not possible. And so this process allowed Lee to repeatedly wrong-foot the Barisan, forcing them to shift positions. And this confused the public and allowed the PAP to portray the Barisan as duplicitous or simply confused or incompetent. And in particular, Lee Kuan Yew used this to great advantage over the all-important citizenship issue. The merger agreement involved citizens of both territories retaining separate citizenships. They would all become Malaysian nationals who would ostensibly enjoy equal rights and carry the same passport. However, Singapore citizens could only vote in Singapore, while Federation citizens could vote anywhere except in Singapore. This satisfied Lee's need to appear to give the Chinese equal rights, and satisfied the Tunku's need to keep Singaporeans from influencing Federation politics. Publicly, Lee had argued that this was necessary as Singaporean citizens would not necessarily qualify for Federation citizenship. In Chinese, however, the debate took a different complexion due to the difference between the terms nationality, Guomin, and citizenship, Gongmin. Gongmin in Chinese traditionally referred to people in general, And it followed naturally that when the term civil rights entered the Chinese lexicon, it was translated into 公民权. However, the usage of 公民 in the debate over citizenship conflated the ideas of citizenship rights and civil rights as both translated identically into 公民权. So this gave the issue of citizenship rights a far greater significance to the Chinese than can be understood in English, because it appeared to the Chinese that their civil rights were being taken away. And so when this was explained to Lee, he felt that, okay, if we simply drop the term Malaysian nationals and just use Malaysian citizens as a common term for all citizens of Malaysia, including Singapore, this should be sufficient to resolve the issue. So Lee submitted an aid memoir to the skeptical Tunku outlining the issue and his proposal, making it clear that Singapore Chinese were dissatisfied and it was crucial that they were convinced, and really it was just a change of the nomenclature. The substance would be the same. So when the Tunku finally agreed, Lee followed the announcement of his success with the announcement of the referendum on merger, allowing him to enter the referendum on the back of a victory. And Lee's plan worked. The Chinese press spoke approvingly of the autonomy for education, labour and economic issues in Lee's proposals. He was also aided by events across the causeway. For example, throughout 1961, the Federation government had been pressuring Chinese secondary schools to join the national system. In August, Lim Lian Giok, one of the most strident critics of conversion, was stripped by the Federation government of his citizenship. And cowed, many schools agreed to switch to becoming national schools, teaching in English and Malay. It spelt the end of publicly funded Chinese language education. Singapore Chinese watched this unfold with horror from across the causeway and were determined not to meet the same fate. Lee's plan offered autonomy for education. The Barisan's plan did not. And so the Barisan never had a chance. They were in a no-win situation and up against the best political mind that this island has probably ever produced. So on 20th November 1961, just a few months after the white paper was introduced, it was presented to the Legislative Assembly. After a long, stormy, 13-day debate, the PAP used parliamentary procedure to force a vote. The Barisan, United People's Party, and Workers' Party members walked out of the chamber, whereupon the PAP and Singapore Alliance members who remained approved the white paper. The form and structure of merger was sealed. But there was one more hurdle. The government would have to go to the public. And when we return, we will discuss the referendum on merger. BFM 89.9. Good afternoon. This is Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, and I'm PJ Thum. If you've just joined us, welcome to this week's episode of The History of Singapore, Hobson's Choice. Early on in the merger process, in December 1961, Goh Keng Swee formally committed the PAP to a referendum on merger. It had to do so or be vulnerable to accusations that it was railroading Singapore into merger over the wishes of the people of Singapore. The Federation and British leadership felt it was, quote, a major tactical error, unquote, to move the vote from the Legislative Assembly, where the PAP had a rock-solid majority and could win every vote, to the public, where the Barisan held an advantage. But Lee Kuan Yew said, don't worry. He promised what he called a Hobson's choice. He would ensure that all alternatives were for yes, but all alternatives to the PAP option would be inferior, leaving the public with no real choice. The British called this, quote, a dishonest maneuver, unquote, and the Tunku called it, quote, a dirty game, unquote. But they wanted merger, so they both stayed silent. And so, alongside the white paper on merger that we discussed before the break, the government introduced a bill for a national referendum. The three choices presented were labelled alternatives A, B, and C. Alternative A was the PAP's proposal for merger, in which Singaporeans were quarantined in Singapore but retained autonomy in terms of education and labour, but also were underrepresented in the Dewan Rakyat. Alternative B was for Singapore joining on an equal basis with all other Malayan states, which the PAP called the Barisan position, but as I mentioned, was a position that the Barisan had long abandoned. And option C was the Singapore Alliance's position. Alternative C stated that Singapore should not join on terms less favourable than those granted to North Borneo and Sarawak. At this time, however, it was still not known what terms the Borneo territories would obtain, so really it was kind of pointless, it was just there to confuse the issue. Supported by the Singapore Alliance, the PAP easily won the Legislative Assembly vote and passed the National Referendum Bill. Left without an alternative to back, the Barisan decided to advocate casting blank votes. However, again, poor politicians that they were, they announced this too early, and the PAP again outmaneuvered them by adding a clause to the National Referendum Bill which stipulated that blank votes meant that voters were unable to make a decision, in which case the government would decide on its behalf. Of course, as any Singaporean will tell you, when the PAP has to go to the public for a vote, it always accompanies this with a sudden surge in performance. 1961 was no different. Checked by a vigorous opposition in the assembly, the PAP actually generally governed capably and responsibly and successfully. It made important compromises, like on the controversial Chinese school reforms, and convened a commission to examine the issue, which had the convenient effect of drawing out the issue until after the merger issue had been decided. It temporarily backed down on Nanta, allowing the university to move forward. It restored civil service pay. The trade unions allied with the PAP outdid the left-wing trade unions in aggressively fighting for workers' rights. In particular, Devan Nair took on the Straits Times in a well-publicised battle in the Industrial Arbitration Court, which ran 42 sessions from 10th October 1961 to 26 June 1962. And from May 1962 to September 1963, Lee Kuan Yew embarked on a public tour of the island. In advance of his visit, roads, streetlights and other amenities were repaired, drawing a direct link between improvements and the PAP. He spoke to constituents in four languages, listening to problems and ordering accompanying civil servants to act on them. And at the same time, the government's planning and legislation began to pay off. From 1961-62, employment rose by over 5,000 jobs, average hourly earnings rose from 80 cents to 88 cents, and perhaps most importantly, a massive 19,550 new housing units were completed by the HDB. This last achievement was considered so critical that a new highest national honour, the Darya Utama Temasek, was created and awarded to HDB Chairman Lim Kim San in June 1962. And indeed, Lee Kuan Yew later credited his 1963 re-election to the HDB flats built in his constituency. In July 1962, at a meeting in London with the British Colonial Secretary and the Tunku, Lee also overcame the last major public concern in the merger plan, as I mentioned, by convincing the Tunku to make the important change in the nomenclature of citizenship. So, on 15th August, Lee returned to Singapore in triumph and declared, quote, "My job is to get what my people want. And if they want citizenship, I get them citizenship," unquote. And it worked. The press believed the situation favourably resolved. He pressed his advantage and declared the referendum would be held almost immediately on 1st September 1962, before the full implications of what he'd done could sink in. Lee's Hobson's choice ensured that the Barisan could not plausibly back any of the alternatives on offer. Their campaign was not well run and their message was muddled. The PAP, by contrast, not only hammered home a single message that option A was the best and only possible outcome for merger, but it strained its campaign to the legal limit, It freely used public money and government facilities to promote alternative A. It deluged the state with radio broadcasts, advertising jingles, posters, pamphlets, including 200,000 free copies of Lee's book, The Battle for Merger. It mobilized the ostensibly non-political People's Association and Works Brigade to canvass voters and distribute campaign material. On the ballot paper, the Singapore flag was placed next to Alternative A and foreign flags next to Alternatives B and C. On information posters, all hands were seen putting a cross next to Alternative A. On polling day itself, the Singapore flag was hoisted outside the centres. Election officers used Alternative A as an example when instructing voters how to mark their ballots. Rumours flew that, through the use of serial numbers on the ballots, voters who cast blank votes would be identified and lose their citizenships. Goh Keng Swee sent out 40 trucks fitted with loudspeakers to warn people that blank votes would be considered a vote for Alternative B, which would cause Singaporeans to lose their citizenship. The government was also heavily aided by the Singapore Chinese Chamber of Commerce, who came out strongly in favour of the PAP's proposals for merger due to the concessions in commerce and education and labour. They took out full-page advertisements in the newspapers urging people to vote in favour of Alternative A, emphasising that it would preserve business and culture and jobs. On referendum day, 71.1% of voters chose Alternative A and 25.8% cast blank ballots. The Barisan, furious at the PAP's methods, accused the PAP of cheating. It is impossible to say what the outcome would have been with a differently worded ballot or one with an option for no, or even simply a fair constitutional process. But there is no doubt that Singapore's people wanted merger. And there is no doubt they had chose what seemed to be the best available option on the ballot. Lee had presented a merger agreement that ostensibly protected Singaporean interests, was endorsed by the commercial and traditional elite of Singapore, and ensured that there was no plausible alternative arrangement. Nor was a second bite at the apple likely. Is merger now or merger never? And so Singaporeans voted for the best option on the ballot, which was Alternative A. Looking back today, the Barisan never had a chance. Lee controlled the process. He had access to the Tungku. The British and the Federation were on his side. He had a rock-solid majority in the Assembly. He had government resources. He had all the advantages, and of course, he had his own ruthless political instinct and ability. And unlike 1957, when the British played fair and included Lee in their negotiations along with Lim Yew Hock, this time they ensured that the Barisan were not part of the process. But knowingly or unknowingly, this is where Lee Kuan Yew sowed the seeds of his failure and the eventual failure of Malaysia. Because to save himself, Lee made crucial, critical compromises. He gave away an important chunk of Singapore's sovereignty in order to ensure that he could stay in power. It was a betrayal of the people of Singapore, but cleverly presented as their salvation. He agreed to a highly flawed form of Malaysia where Singapore would be quarantined, would be unequal, would be in a quasi-colonial status. He agreed to a form of Malaysia in which it was assumed that Singapore and Singaporeans could not be trusted and had to be held separate from the rest of Malaysia. And all this to keep himself in power. And maybe it might have worked. We'll never know. Maybe the people of Singapore could have lived with it. But what we do know is that Lee Kuan Yew could not live with it. The moment that Malaysia was created, the moment Lee Kuan Yew's position in Singapore was secure, he would turn his energies to overturning the constitutional straitjacket that he himself had eagerly helped tie onto Singapore. And we all know how that turned out. We'll talk about that in a few weeks. But first, over the next 2 weeks, we turn to the final act of the merger process. the Tunku's final demand before the creation of Malaysia could take place. The arrest and detention of Singapore's opposition. This would be the infamous Operation Cold Store. But the bitter wrangling over Cold Store would almost end Malaysia before it even began. It's a complicated story, so it will take 2 weeks to tell. So see you next week for the first half of this story called The Night of Long Knives. As always, if you have any questions, comments or feedback, please email me at thehistoryofsingapore@gmail.com or visit my webpage at thehistoryofsingapore.com. If you'd like to support the podcast, please visit Patreon, patreon.com/pjthumb. Thank you very much and see you next week. This has been The History of Singapore, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.